This is the BC Youth Conference 2017. General theme is Moses. Our speaker is Brother Jason Hensley. This is class note number 5, entitled Alone in Midian.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Oh, I left my Bible. That's bad. All right, good evening again.
Good evening.
I'm really tempted to yell out locust and see what you guys do. So, all right, here we are, class number 5. And we are talking now about Moses in Midian. So we are reaching the 80-year mark for Moses. We're going to finish up Exodus chapter 2. Class 5, we are talking about true humility. And so to review what we've covered in the last five days, let's start from the beginning. So we're discussing true humility. So the first thing that we saw is true humility acknowledges that God's ways are higher than man's ways. Very good. Second was true humility waits for God's vengeance. Good. The third was true humility sees that all things revolve around the Lord. There you go. I always get confused on whether it's acknowledges, admits, who was it? We were talking about synonym. Anyway, never mind. Okay, yesterday's was true humility is grateful for chastening. Yeah, that we need practice on that one. Okay, fourth one was true humility is grateful for chastening. Just chastening, it's all right. Okay, grateful for chastening. And today's, we are now looking at, those are kind of the breaking you part of true humility. And now, this class is going to bring us to the building up of true humility. So we're going to look at Moses fleeing to Midian, see God's providence in his life, and once again, see the Lord Jesus Christ. Right? How can you get away from that? So, core message. True humility acknowledges that God can work in us mightily. So that is where this all shifts. Before, it was essentially about us being small, right? We wait for God's vengeance, not our own. We know that His ways are higher than our ways. We know that all things are about the Lord and not about us. We are chastened, we're made small, we're crushed. And this now is acknowledging that it is God who can do great things through us. So this is the difference. We've been brought low on the first four. This is the end where we are lifted up, but only in God. Through God. The why question is, why did Moses meet Reuel and his family? And I don't mean because he sat down by a well, right? That's not the answer. Yeah, I mean, that's the literal answer. But the point of the question is, we know that all things work together for good. So why is it then that in the providence of God, God specifically had him sit randomly on this well and meet these daughters, and eventually meet Reuel? What was the point of that? Was it just so Moses would marry Zipporah, or was there something more there? Let's take a look. So, Moses is blindsided by what has happened, right? Everything looked like he was where he needed to be. He was in the house of Pharaoh. At least he had been before he forsook Egypt. He then forsook Egypt, and the 400 years looked like they were almost up. The fourth generation was almost done. He was 40 like Joseph, right? All these things had come together, and Moses thought, this is it. He saw the Egyptian beating the Hebrew. Here we go. And yet it didn't come together right. So this seems to be what God does often with his servants. And it's fascinating just to look at this. I'll give a couple of examples. But God will make it look like something is going to happen, and all the circumstances seem perfect for it to take place, and it doesn't happen. And in fact, like the opposite of what you expect to happen happens. So let me just show you what I mean by that. Genesis chapter 15. This is the story of Abram. Right? Come over to Genesis 15. We actually had a reference to this in one of the discussion groups this morning. Genesis 15. Abram has been told that he is going to have a seed who will inherit these promises that will be multitudinous. However, things aren't working out so well, right? Genesis 15, starting at verse 1, it says, "After these things, the word of the Lord came unto Abram in a vision, saying, Fear not, Abram, I am thy shield and thy exceeding great reward. Abram said, Lord God, what wilt thou give me? Note the problem. Seeing I go childless, and the steward of my house is this Eliezer of Damascus. Abram said, Behold, to me thou hast given no seed, and lo, one born in my house is my heir." So what's the issue? He has no child, right? And his heir is who? Eliezer. It's like the servant. So that's really not so good. How's that supposed to work? And so God says to him, well, you know what? Eliezer's not going to be your heir. Verse 4. This shall not be thine heir. So that's what Moses is told. He will not be your heir. Or not Moses, Abram. That's what Abram's told. So 10 years later, after the promise is given in Genesis chapter 12, Sarah thinks that she has a solution, right? And so Sarah says, well, why don't you try with Hagar and we'll see what happens? And we know how that goes, right? Abraham, at this point, says, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. And God says, no, Sarah will bear a son. So they have to keep waiting. Finally, after 25 years, the promise happens. Just think about that, right? They know we're going to have a son, and everything looks right when Abram's 75. But they have to keep waiting and waiting and waiting, and it doesn't actually happen until 25 years later. That is a long time. Now, there's more to it than that, because just consider Joseph's story, right? He is given this promise. Genesis 37, verses 6 to 8, this is where he sees the sun, moon, and stars do what? Bow down to him, right? So his brethren understand this, and they say, what? Are you really going to reign over us? Shalt thou indeed reign over us? He then has the second dream, right, where the sheaves are now bowing down to him. And so it's the same kind of thing. Actually, I think it, is it the other way around? Sheaves, then? Anyway, oh well. Yeah, thank you. Other way around. So first he has the sheaves dream, then he dreams of the sun, moon, and stars. So how's that possible, right? How is this supposed to take place? So he's sitting there, Joseph's sitting there wondering that. And you can just imagine that when Joseph is sold to the Ishmaelites and he's sold to Potiphar, he then becomes the overseer in Potiphar's house. Suddenly, this child who was one of the youngest in the house starts to get some authority. And you could just see Joseph thinking, huh, well, I mean, Potiphar's pretty important in Egypt, right? Maybe this is how the promise is going to work out. And now I'm over all of Potiphar's house. Maybe someday my brethren will come and bow down. And he's trying to put this together. How's this going to work? And then, all of a sudden, he's in prison. Whoa, that's not what I expected, right? Like, how does he put that together? He's just sitting there thinking, that's definitely not what I thought was going to happen. So now how's the promise going to take place? And so everything that he expected to have happen is shattered, is gone. This is what God does. He makes a promise, and then he purposefully puts things into our lives that look like they negate the promise. So he's promised to us, all things work together for good. Do we believe it? And do we believe it even when it looks like all things are working together for bad? Right? This is what he does. And so you see this over and over. I mean, just imagine with David, right? He's son-in-law to the king. Everything's perfect. Everything is perfect. He's son-in-law to the king, to Saul. He's working in the palace. It looks like he should be able to just take over. And then, 1 Samuel 20, he has to run. And David's just thinking, huh? How does this fit? Same thing with Hezekiah. Hezekiah's got the people faithful, ready to stand against the Assyrians, and then struck with leprosy. What? This is what God does. So Moses goes to Midian. That's actually Moses. I took that picture. I'm just kidding. Sorry. Okay. So Moses runs, right? Moses runs, and the record reads as though Moses is just passing through. So I want us to notice this, just to get a sense as to what's going on here. Exodus chapter 2 and verse 15. Take a look. Verse 15 says, Exodus 2:15, "Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh," and this here, I think this is a summary, "and dwelt in the land of Midian." So he's fleeing from Pharaoh, and by the way, he goes and he lives in Midian. In order to make that happen, it says he's running and he sits down by a well. So to me, it sounds like Moses is just passing through. He's tired. He sits down next to a well. Eventually, he ends up dwelling in Midian. So he's sitting down by a well, and something extremely odd happens. Consider what happens next. So Moses is sitting by this well. And who comes to the well? Reuel's daughters. So they show up there in verse 16. There's seven of them. And they come to draw water, and they fill the troughs. Now, I don't know if you've thought about this, but try and picture this. And we're going to read verses 16 and 17. And as we read it, ask yourself, right, you have to ask this, and it's not why. You have to ask, what's odd about this? Because there's something really weird. Starting at verse 16. Verse 16 says, "Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters. They came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. The shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock." What's weird about that? Yeah, what's going on with these shepherds? Can you picture this? Here's seven girls. Seven girls are getting water for the flocks, and up come these shepherd guys, and they're like, "Hey, ladies," or you know, whatever it is that they're doing, right? And they like try and mess things up for these women and try and make them go away, right? And by the way, this actually is a daily occurrence. We know that because they come home, right? They come home, and in verse 20, in verse 18, Reuel's like, "Wow, how are you home so soon today?" He's shocked. So this is like a normal thing that these guys come and they cause problems. "Oh, you know, I like your hair today," or whatever it is that they might say. Right? They're saying stuff. You know, "Oh, it looks different. What'd you do?" Whatever it is. So they come and they're causing issues. So what's going on with these shepherds? So that's weird, first of all. Anything else that you notice that's odd? That is very strange, right? This is like Moses, like, busting out, right? I mean, here's these shepherds that are causing issues, and Moses is like, "Come on, guys, bring it on," right? And the guys are like, "Whoa, this guy's scary," and they run away, right? That's weird. Okay, do you notice anything else? How about the fact that here's a priest whose daughters have to shepherd his flock? That's weird, and we'll talk about why that's weird. Let's see, I think there was one more. He's called an Egyptian. Yeah, so that's also interesting. So he's called an Egyptian. Egyptians are not into sheep, right? So let's talk about this idea of them being priest's daughters. This, I think, is probably one of the stranger aspects of this whole thing. They were priest's daughters. What's up with that? Okay, you got to ask this, because consider, in ancient society, who were the priests? In terms of like the strata of ancient society, were priests at the top or at the bottom? These guys are at the top, right? Because if you're talking like a pagan society, right, the priest has to be at the top, because this is the guy that you want to make happy. Because if you don't, he's going to like pray to the gods, and the gods are going to like burn up your house or whatever, right? This is supposed to be the guy that has this link with the gods. So priests are like at the top. So priests were always taken care of. They had a lot of authority. Why? what's going on with Reuel? You know, these shepherds are causing issues for his daughters? There's a bunch of shepherds there. Why are they not taking care of his flock? There's just weird things happening here. Just consider, under the law of Moses, right? Obviously not a pagan society, but it's same similar time period, right? Under the law of Moses, here's what happened with the priests. I meant for us to go to Leviticus chapter 7. Come over to Leviticus 7. Leviticus 7, starting at verse 35. The priests were taken care of. So look for that as we read verse 34. Verse 34 says, Leviticus 7, "For the wave breast and the heave shoulder have I taken of the children of Israel from off the sacrifices of their peace offerings, and have given them unto Aaron the priest and unto his sons by a statute forever from among the children of Israel." And so the priests were taken care of by the congregation, right? They also ate of the meal offering, and then they were given the tithe to provide for them because the priests didn't have any other job. There was no other way that they would be able to support themselves aside from being taken care of by the congregation. So that's how the law of Moses set it up. And in fact, when you go to the New Testament, you actually see the Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 13, he states that they which minister live of the things of the temple. This was not a new idea to the law of Moses. This was how ancient society worked with priests. Priests were supported by their people. And not only were they supported by their people, but they were respected. They were the important people. If you were the friend of a priest, you know, you were in high places. Right? That's a good deal. So you have to ask yourself then, what's going on here? Why is there this priest whose daughters are like harassed by the shepherds? On top of that, why does he have his own sheep? You know, people should be bringing sheep to him as gifts. So why does he have his own flock? And why are they being shepherded by his daughters when there's a ton of other shepherds around? It's just kind of a weird deal. Why are his followers not supporting him? Well, think back to this. We are talking about the land of Midian. Yeah? The land of Midian, where's Midian come from? Abraham's children. So let's go to Genesis 25. Let's take a look at the roots here of Midian. This is kind of interesting. Genesis 25. Now, you looked at this, I believe, when you were going through your workbook, but I think it's just a good reminder for us. Take a look at the roots of Midian. Genesis 25, starting at verse 1, says, Genesis 25, 1, "Then again Abraham took a wife, and her name was Keturah. She bare him Zimram, and Jokshan, and Medan, and Midian, and Ishbak, and Shuah." So Midian is actually one of the sons of Abraham. Now, do you remember? It's at the time when God was going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, God said, "Should I reveal my plan to Abraham?" And he said, "Yes, I will, because he will do something." Do you remember what it was? "He will command his children after me." That's Genesis 18, verse 19. "He will command his children after me." And so I think we can say pretty certainly that Midian knew the truth. That's Midian, Abraham's son, right? Midian knew the truth, Abraham's son. And so then, while there were a number of people in Midian who forsook Yahweh, right? They became a pagan society. However, it would make sense that there would be those who were faithful. Now, add to that, that Reuel has a very interesting name. Anybody know what Reuel means? Friend of God. Now, think about this. Why is the name Friend of God a very strange name for a pagan priest to have? Note, it's not Friend of Yahweh. It's Friend of God. Why is that an odd name for a pagan priest? Yeah, they're not friends with their gods. That's true. Their gods were kind of crazy. Yeah. His name is not friend of gods or friend of the gods. Pagans had a ton of gods. And I think it would be very, very odd, very unique for a pagan to have the name friend of God, singular. Because who would they be talking about, right? Like, which one out of the 2,500 gods we have? I mean, it just doesn't make sense. Friend of God, this was not a pagan kind of name. Reuel's name was focused around the idea of one God. Add to that the fact that whenever he shows up, consider what he's doing. Exodus chapter 2 and verse 20, he urges his daughters to invite Moses to a meal, right? He says, why are you back so soon? Wow, how did you just leave him there? Go back and get him. And so the daughters have to go get Moses. Moses shows up after being at Mount Sinai and seeing the burning bush, and he says, Reuel, I have to take your daughter, your grandkids, off like tons of miles back to Egypt, and I'm going to go back to where they wanted to kill me, and it's going to turn out okay, though, don't worry. And Reuel's like, go in peace. Wow, you know, yeah, and take my grandkids and my daughter and all that, you know, it's astonishing that that's what he says. He then shows up in Exodus 18, and he actually gives Moses sound advice for leading the people. This is not the kind of thing that we would expect from a pagan priest. This is a generous person. It's a person that gives sound advice. But I think the most telling thing of who he is actually shows up after the Exodus. Just look at this verse. It's Exodus 18 and verse 12. What do you think, or just read this, and consider what would be impossible in this verse for a pagan priest to do. What would be impossible for a pagan priest to do? So this is Jethro, Reuel, the same person. Exodus 18, verse 12, Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took a burnt offering and sacrifices for God. And Aaron came and all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God. What would be impossible there for a pagan priest to do? Eat bread before God. Can you imagine that? This priest who's like filled tons of people's lives with apostasy shows up and is sitting and fellowshipping with God? No way. Like, I can't picture that at all, right? You think about Leviticus 10, verses 1 and 2. Do you remember what story that is? That's the story of Nadab and Abihu. They show up and they offer strange fire before God. And what happens? You know, and they're burned up immediately. If Reuel's sitting there, pagan priest, eating before God, he's done, right? God's not going to tolerate something like that. God says in Deuteronomy 12, verses 29 to 32, to get rid of all the worship from the land when you go in. And I just, for me at least, I can't picture something like this happening with a guy who believes in this, in like a plethora of gods and has taught people so. And so adding to that then, it's interesting that the next day he gives Moses this awesome advice. Consider, once again, how these could only be the words of... Whoa. That was exciting. That fan, I'm like so amazed that it still runs. Even after that, too, it was still going. Wow. So, Exodus 18, look at what he says here. These are only the words that a man of God could say. Hearken now unto my voice. I will give thee counsel, and God shall be with thee. Be thou for the people to Godward, that thou mayest bring the causes unto God. Thou shalt teach them ordinances and laws, and shalt show them the way wherein they must walk, and the work that they must do. Moreover, thou shalt provide out of all the people able men, such as fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness, and place such over them to be rulers of thousands, rulers of hundreds, rulers of 50, rulers of tens. What do you see there that only a man of God would say? Yeah, look at his qualifications. These are the important kind of people you need to choose. Those who fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness. I mean, what would somebody in the world say? Right? They'd say, you're going to choose people that can destroy any of their opponents. Right? Somebody comes up and asks for judgment, and, you know, they're just going to be able to make a decision, boom, and the person says, oh, but that's not, too bad, right? You know, you want to choose somebody tough. No, he says, those who fear God. Men of truth, those who hate covetousness. Those are qualifications that a faithful person would put forth. On top of that, he has this like complete confidence that I think only a faithful priest would be able to say that this is godly advice, and if you do this, God will be with you. And what happens after he does it? God is with him. It actually happens, right? It's good advice. So able men, those who fear God, men of truth, hating covetousness. So, I would just like to suggest to you, perhaps then, that is why Reuel is not supported by the people. And perhaps then, that is why Moses, by chance, sits down at the well where Reuel's daughters need help. Now, going back to Moses, right? Let's think a little bit about him. So there's Moses, he's sitting there at the well, and Moses has this sense of justice. We saw it when he killed the Egyptian. And so here he is, watching this whole thing taking place, and he sees these girls struggling with these shepherds. He can't just stand by and watch. And so what he does is he's a man who's mighty indeed. You know, Moses probably rarely ever had anybody say no to him, right? So he's probably not used to that kind of thing. And somebody that's like that, they carry themselves in a way where they can say, you do that, and people know, like, I'm going to do it, right? So he's a man who's mighty indeed, and so he stands up against the shepherds, and there's something about him. You know, I mean, maybe Moses was like huge and buff. Probably not, right? Especially to be able to make a whole group of men go away. But something about what he does, he's able to say, get out of here, and the shepherds are like, this isn't fun anymore, right? And they leave. So they go away. It's pretty astonishing that he does that. And yet he does more than just rescue the girls. And you wouldn't have seen this because this is in the Hebrew. But look at what it says about him drawing the water. Verse 19, it says, and he drew water for their flocks. Now, this is how the girls describe it. This is how the daughters describe it. They say, he got enough for us, and he watered our flocks. So he doesn't just get water for the sheep, but take note of this, guys. He gets water for the girls too, right? So that's what he does. He saves them, and then he gets water for the girls. Now, if you look at this in the Hebrew, this here, this word, enough for us, that word there, you know what? I don't actually remember which word it is. In this phrase, yeah, I think it's enough for us. Yep, it is. It's enough for us. That's your word. In the Hebrew, enough for us is actually this right here. It's a dalo dala. And it's actually the same word twice. This is your Strong's number, 1802. Now, the reason that matters is you may be familiar with this kind of construction. It actually shows up in Genesis 3. We talk about that a lot. This dying, thou shalt die. If you're familiar with that whole concept, dying, thou shalt die. This is basically a structure that you see all the time in Hebrew. It is one word repeated. It's a verb just repeated after itself. So, I mean, if you wanted to be really literal, you'd say, he drew, and watered our flocks, right? And obviously the translators knew that that made no sense, so that's why they didn't put that there. But the way that the Hebrew translates is it basically means he drew a ridiculous amount of water. That's what it's saying. Like, it's not like he just, you know, drew enough for us, but he drew and he fed the amount of sheep that it takes 7 girls to shepherd. And then he was like, and do you ladies need water too? And he kept going. So that's like pretty amazing. Here's how Young's Literal translates it. It says, and they say, a man, an Egyptian, hath delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and hath diligently drawn for us. So he didn't just draw, but he was going. He just kept going. That's Moses' character, right? And I think that it's just, it's neat to see, yes, he has this strong sense of justice, but there's more to it. Because he was like totally crushed, right? He's sitting down by a well wondering, what's the purpose of my life? And he sees this, and he doesn't just save the girls, but he's like, oh, I'm here, I can draw the water for you, why don't I do that? And so he draws a ton of water for them. What's neat about that is really, this is the same kind of attitude that you see of the Lord Jesus Christ. You remember the story of the feeding of the 5,000. What happened right before that? Why did Christ go out to the seaside? He wanted a quiet place to pray because something had taken place. John the Baptist had been killed. So he's thinking about his own death. You know, he actually equates, he puts the two together. He says, Elijah has come already, and they have done whatsoever they listed, and so shall they do to the Son of Man. Right? So he recognizes John the Baptist's death is a foretaste of mine. That's from Matthew 17, by the way. I think it's verse 12. But it might not be. So he recognizes my death is coming, right? And he's thinking, I got to be out in this quiet place. I want to be by myself. So he says, go across the sea. So they're going on the Sea of Galilee. And the way that John puts it is, and he lifted up his eyes, right? Christ lifts up his eyes. They get to the other seaside. And all of a sudden, there's this huge multitude of people. Now, you can just imagine, if you're thinking, I need time to pray, and you see like thousands of people who want to talk to you, you'd be like, no. Not going to happen. You guys, this is my time to pray. Sorry, I need some headspace. I'll talk to you tomorrow. Right? Christ doesn't do that. He actually takes the time to sit down, and he heals them, and not only that, he starts preaching to them. That is amazing that that is the kind of person that he was. He didn't say, I'm too tired, I'm too busy. This is the kind of attitude, like what Moses had, and like what the Lord Jesus had, that we need to be able to demonstrate in the ecclesia. Right? When the ecclesia has a need, we say, I am there. I'll be there. Now, a few unexpected things happen. So Moses just sat down by the well, right? And the girls come home, right? And Reuel says, wow, why are you home so early? And they explain, oh, an Egyptian came and, you know, da-da-da-da-da. So either he looked like an Egyptian, which I don't think he did because I think he, went to suffer with the Hebrews. So they probably had a little bit of talking. You know, hey, where are you from? You look a little ragged. Like, what's going on? Oh, I'm from Egypt, da-da-da-da-da. So they say an Egyptian came, right? And their father says, well, you just left him there? I mean, girls, he drew you water, right? And the girls, oh, oops. You know, and they go back to the well and they say, hey, do you want to come back? And so that's how it goes. He comes back to their house, and the verse is very succinct. And Moses married Zipporah. There you go. So he gets back there, and ta-da, he gets a wife. So that's how it goes. Now then, he has a son whom he names what? Gershom. That's his firstborn. And what's funny about it is these two verses really cover decades and decades of time. So what I think because of these two verses, we sometimes get this impression that when Moses goes back to Midian, it's like him and Zipporah and like cute little baby, you know, riding on the whatever it was, a donkey or a camel or something. Yeah, yeah, they're doing that, that's right. Like Absalom. Anyway. yes. So, okay, sorry. I keep thinking about me like trying to ride a donkey or a mule. That's what it was. Okay. This is ridiculous. All right. So the verses cover two decades of time. Now, the point of this is we want to recognize the kids were actually old when this happened. So, take a look. We know that Moses was 40 years old at Sinai, right? So he's there for 40 years, and at the end of this time, his children still seem to be young. So, I don't know what I'm saying here. His children still seem to be young. And the point of this is to recognize that, yes, actually, his children are young. That's what I was trying to say. I got distracted by the mule. Sorry. All right. So last week, I had to pretend I was Absalom, and I was riding a mule at kids' camp. And I don't even know how to ride. We don't even have horses, like, in L.A. So I don't know how to ride one of those. And apparently, I did it like this, and that's not how it goes. But anyway, oh well, you guys are all cultured and you know how to ride horses, but I don't, okay? So, So, what happened? Let's focus. His children were young. And we know that because when Moses goes to Egypt, he puts them on a donkey. Now, this is not the kind of thing where, like, he has Gershom when he's been in Midian for, like, 2 years, and Gershom is 38 years old, and here's, like, 80-year-old Moses with a 38-year-old son, and he's like, okay, son, I'm going to lift you on the donkey, right? And he sticks him on there and says, okay, let's go. And he, leads his, like, big son along. That's not what's going on, right? He sets them on a donkey. We're talking, this is like a little kid. So that's what we're looking at. These aren't teenage boys, right? I mean, otherwise, why would they even need a donkey? Like, he could ride them. So, what's the point of this? Why does it actually matter how old his kids are? Well, I think it helps us to understand their names. So he has the kids while he's been in Midian for a while. And the reason that that's important is because of what the kids' names mean. So the first one's name is Gershom, right? Let's read through these verses here and consider why Moses named his son Gershom. It says, Exodus 18, 2-4, then Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, took Zipporah, Moses' wife, after he had sent her back, and her two sons, of which the name of the one was Gershom. Here's the reason. For he said, I have been an alien in a strange land. So that's why he named his son Gershom. Gershom means stranger or foreigner. Now, remember, we talked about this. Hebrew names are just the words. So if you wanted to say foreigner, you would say Gershom in Hebrew. So when cute little Gershom walked to the store and said, hey, can I buy candy? And the guy at the store was like, oh, yeah, hey, kid, what's your name? Oh, my name is Foreigner, right? And that's a weird name, kid. Like, why are you not called that? Oh, because my dad's a stranger in a strange land, right? Like, that's the idea. So Moses gives his son this name because he wants him to remember that. My father is a stranger in a strange land. So now here's the question. What land is the strange land? Let's go to Acts chapter 7. So, what land is the strange land? And from what land is Gershom a stranger? Or is Moses a stranger? Are we talking the promised land? He's a stranger from the promised land? Or are we talking Egypt? Take a look at Acts chapter 7. This will clear up a little bit of the problem for us. Acts 7 and verse 29 says, Acts 7, 29, then fled Moses at this saying and was a stranger in the land of Midian. So we know then that when it says that he's a stranger, this name foreigner means that he's a stranger in Midian. Okay? So Moses recognizes I'm a stranger in Midian. All right. So then with that in mind, where's his homeland? Egypt or the promised land? Any thoughts? I don't think it's Egypt. Moses had forsaken Egypt, right? He was done with that. He'd forsaken Egypt. And in fact, I think we can actually know a little more. Because if you actually look at that phrase there, I've been an alien in a strange land, you may notice that it actually is an echo. It actually is a quotation from something. It just so happens to be a quotation from Genesis 15. Genesis 15, a familiar chapter? Genesis 15, verse 13, and he said unto Abram, know of a surety that thy seed shall be a stranger in a land that is not theirs, and shall serve them, and they shall afflict them 400 years. Do you see what Moses is doing? This is awesome. Here's Moses, and he's in Midian, and he names his son after the promise in Genesis 15. Moses was broken. Moses didn't understand how the promise was going to work. He believed that he was somehow going to be the deliverer, but none of it made sense. And yet he's sitting there, and towards the end of his time in Midian, he has a son, and he says, we're going to name him Foreigner because we still believe in the promises. We don't know how they're going to happen, but we believe it. Now then, I think you can even reinforce this when you just consider what Eliezer means, right? He says Eliezer, which means God is my help, because the God of my father said he was mine help, and look at this, and delivered me from the sword of Pharaoh. This is towards the end of his time in Midian, and this is the way that Moses is thinking. You know, for a long time, I always thought these, like, 40 years in Midian were the spiritual dearth, you know, and things were bad, but that's not how it was. Moses actually recognized God has been working throughout this time. God delivered me, and God brought me here, right? God spared me from Pharaoh. He brought me to the descendants of Abraham. I've married into the family of a faithful priest. And so I think just as God had helped Moses, Moses names his son God as help because he recognizes that God will help the children of Israel. All right. We have 12 minutes. This is rough. Okay. So, I'm going to suggest to you, I think Moses also wrote Psalm 90 during that time. Now, I mean, it's hard to try and, you know, figure out exactly when Psalms were written. We know that Moses wrote it, right? The title says that in Psalm 90. But I think there's just a few indications that Psalm wrote this before the Exodus occurred. Did I say Psalm wrote this? Moses wrote this before the Exodus occurred. So consider this. Here's some reasons. First of all, did you notice how long Moses said men would live? Right? He says, the years of our lives are 70, and if by reason of, what is it, of our affliction, our strength, yeah, thank you. Affliction didn't make sense. Reason of strength, they be 80, right? This is like where he limits the lifespan. It would be awfully strange, I think, for Moses to write this after he was 80 years old, right? He says, essentially, we live to be 80 years old, and if he's like 95 writing it, that just doesn't make sense. The days of our years are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they be 80. So he limits that. At the time, he also acknowledges Israel's wickedness. Just take a look at Psalm 90, verses 7 and 9. He says, we are consumed by thine anger, by thy wrath are we troubled. Right? This is a time in which Israel is being consumed by God's wrath. What better time than when they're in slavery? Thou hast set our iniquities before thee, our secret sins in the light of thy countenance. Consumed by thine anger, their secret sins, right? Their idol worship. He then prays for their deliverance. He says, return, O Lord, how long? Right? When are you going to deliver us from this? And it's been years in which they've seen evil. And yet at the same time, there are words of a man who has actually learned humility. Notice what he says about mankind. Psalm 90, verses 3 to 4. Thou turnest man to destruction and sayest, return, ye children of men, for 1,000 years in thy sight are but as yesterday when it is past. Right? We are nothing compared to you. And so this is the point at which Moses had learned the lesson. So at least just consider this idea. I think Psalm 90 fits nicely there, particularly because limiting the lifespan to 80 years, I don't really see how that can fit anywhere else. So throughout the time, Moses was growing. God was working with him. Okay. Skip that. All right. So we talked about Moses needing to be broken, about needing to be chastened and learning to rejoice in that, needing to learn humility. He had to be broken. And I really think that this is a key verse. Let's go to it, because this verse, I think, is essential for understanding true humility. Luke chapter 3. Do you remember what Stephen says in Acts chapter 7 about Moses? He says, for he supposed that his brethren would understand how that God, by his hand, would deliver them. So Moses saw himself as this integral piece in the deliverance of Israel, right? God, by his hand, would do it. And later, Stephen tells us that it was actually by the hand of the angel. We saw that last night. So Moses had to learn that, in fact, he actually wasn't an integral part to this at all, right? Yeah, he had been preserved when he was young. Yeah, there were no other generation his age, but God did not have to use him. So take a look at Luke chapter 3. I think that this is an awesome point. This is what John the Baptist says to the Jews, right? They think, wow, we're Jews. We have it good. Here we are, the special people. And this is what he says in verse 8. You don't understand. It's not about being Jews. He says in verse 8, bring forth therefore fruits worthy of repentance. That's what matters. Begin not to say within yourselves, we have Abraham to our father. For I say unto you, God is able of these stones to raise up children unto Abraham. So he says, you think you're so cool because you're the children of Abraham? Let me show you how awesome you are. You're about as awesome as that rock. Right? Like, if God wanted to, he could turn that rock into you. I mean, think about that. Right? Can you imagine these guys standing here listening to John? You're like a rock. Right? Oh, that's pretty cool. So the point of this is that God can do what he wants with anyone. And so when you consider what Moses had to endure, he had to become a shepherd. The point was to humble him, but also to teach him that everything that he did was only because of God. He had to learn to rely on God. So yes, he had to be broken, but think about what a shepherd had to do, right? So first of all, Egypt abhors shepherds. That's the first thing. So this is like big humility. But on top of that, look at how Jacob describes being a shepherd. This is Genesis 31, verse 40. Here's how Jacob describes it. And consider how this lifestyle would cause you to rely on God. Jacob says, Genesis 31, 40, thus I was in the day the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, my sleep departed from mine eyes. Right? This is like a situation where life is miserable, and you wake up in the morning and you're like, whew, I survived. You know, the only way is through God. Right? You see what he's saying? At daytime, life was terrible. At night, life was terrible. Right? Basically, life was just really bad all the time, and I could never sleep. He had to become totally reliant on God. Same thing with David, right? When he was a shepherd, the lion and the bear, there was no way that David could come up to a lion and a bear, grab their face, and kill them with his hands unless God was with him, right? It was impossible. And so the point of being a shepherd is that it teaches you, not only like is it lowly, right, because Egyptians abhor shepherds, but it teaches you that you can only do anything through God. He had to become totally reliant on God. It's a job that would teach him true humility because, and this is the essential aspect of humility that we want to look at, it was all about God's greatness. Think about this. Oftentimes when we talk about humility, we talk about one part, right? We think about breaking our pride. We say we have to be crushed. We have to acknowledge we're nothing, right? We have to look at ourselves and be like, wow, God could make that rock into me. But there's more to it. Because humility is not just saying we're nothing. Humility has two parts. It's a recognition that on our own we're nothing. Note that. On our own. But the other side? Because of God, we're something. You remember our core lesson? True humility acknowledges that God can work in us mightily. That's the flip side of humility. It recognizes that we are small and that God is big. All right, let's skip this. Basically, this just reinforces this, but you already know that. Okay, good. So Moses then, makes all these excuses. He only really learned one part of true humility, right? Oh. I still have like another half an hour worth of material. This is terrible. How could I do that to you? Okay. I want to get to the exciting part. Look at this. Half an hour for real. There we go. Okay. This is what I want to leave you with. Moses did didn't understand what God was doing, but he was broken. He didn't realize that God could work in him mightily. But you know what's awesome about this? Is that God was working on a scale that Moses simply could not comprehend. And I don't even think he did by the end of his life. And I think it's going to be the most awesome thing in the kingdom of God to have Moses consider the way in which God worked and to be able to see what we have, because we can see in this hindsight and we can actually see what happened generations later after Moses died, we can see what God did. Consider this. God brought Moses to Reuel to find strength, but there was another reason. He also did it to encourage Israel. Here's what I mean. When the Israelites were going to enter the Promised Land, Moses turned to his in-laws, and he asked them to join him. Let's go to Numbers chapter 10. Numbers 10, and it's verse 29. Verse 29 says, Moses said unto Hobab, the son of Reuel, the Midianite, Moses' father-in-law, we're journeying unto the place of which the Lord said, I will give it you. Come thou with us, and we will do thee good, for the Lord hath spoken good concerning Israel. And thus proceeds this discussion between Moses and his brother-in-law, in which Moses says, come with us. Hobab says, no. Moses says, please. And it sounds like he says no again and doesn't go. But we're not actually told what happens. What's interesting then is that when you come to Judges 1:16, notice this. It says, the children of the Kenite, Moses' father-in-law, went up out of the city of palm trees with the children of Judah into the wilderness of Judah. And they went and dwelt among the people. So what you actually realize is, even though the record kind of ends here, making it sound like Hobab says, no, I'm not going to do it, he actually says, yes, sounds good. What I want you to notice is what Moses' father-in-law is called in Judges chapter 1. Do you see that? He's called the Kenite. You see that there? Children of the Kenite. Do you know why that's interesting? Here's why. Take a look at what Chronicles says in Judah's genealogy about Kenites. 1 Chronicles 2, verse 55. See if you notice anything interesting about Kenites here. It says, the family of the scribes, right? Chronicles is a bunch of genealogies. Families of the scribes which dwelt at Jabez, the Tirathites, the Shimeathites, and the Sukathites. These are the Kenites that came of Hemath, the father of the house of Rechab. And notice where they dwelt? In the tribe of Judah. These are the same guys. Do you see what's going on here? Moses' father-in-law was the Kenite. His children end up dwelling in Judah. And Chronicles tells us that the Kenites eventually had a descendant named Hemath, who became the father of the house of Rechab. Why does that matter? Who are the Rechabites? Do you remember? The Rechabites show up in what book? They show up in the book of Jeremiah, right? So we're talking like years and years later. They show up in the time of Jeremiah, and they actually become an example to Judah of what true faith means. And so in Jeremiah 35, Jeremiah is told, go into the house of the Rechabites and set wine in front of them and see if they drink it, right? And this whole thing then proceeds in which they refuse to drink the wine, and Jeremiah says, why? And they say, because that is what our father commanded. We will not do it. And it becomes this example to Israel in which they obey their father, and God says, if I am your father, you will obey me. Do you see what's happened? Moses sits down by a well in Midian by chance. Centuries later, Jeremiah writes about the descendants of Reuel and uses them to inspire Israel. Can you just think about Moses in the kingdom of God, right? Finding out about how this worked. When he was broken in Midian and thinking, my life doesn't mean anything. What's the purpose of my life? And yet he's sitting there by a well, and the whole time God is working circumstances for centuries later. This is the kind of way that God works. This is the timetable. God will work in us mightily, sometimes even when we have no idea that he's working in us. God could be working in you right now to inspire somebody centuries later. Have you ever thought about that? That's crazy. But that's what he did with Moses. True humility acknowledges that God can work in us mightily. Not only do we need to be broken, not only do we need to realize that we are nothing, but we need to recognize that God can work, and God can do things that can simply blow our minds. And when we recognize that, and we recognize his greatness, then we're beginning to really grasp what humility actually means.